Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today, we'll discuss the article by Frisbee et al. Titled, Distinct Temporal Phases of Microvascular Rarefaction in Skeletal Muscle of Obese Zucker Rats. This article published online October 10, 2014. My guests today are Associate Editor Gary Lopeshuk, lead author Jeff Frisbee, and expert Victor Samokolov. Let's get started.
Okay, thank you, Kara. It's well documented that patients with metabolic syndrome, and this is a mixture of conditions such as impaired glycemic control, atherogenic dyslipidemia, hypertension, and obesity, can have problems with the vasculature in the skeletal muscle, a condition called rarefaction. And what actually is causing the vascular rarefaction is really not clear. And the study by Jeff Frisbee and colleagues has made some important insights into what may actually be causing this vascular rarefaction. And so, Jeff, could you provide me some of the highlights of this paper and the implications of the study?
Certainly, and thank you for the opportunity to discuss our work. Really, this manuscript came out of some of our previous work, which suggested that the chronic reduction in vascular nitric oxide bioavailability that accompanies the metabolic syndrome really was a major causative element of the rarefaction that does occur to the skeletal muscle microcirculation. However, as we continued on, with our research efforts, we realized that in a temporal analysis of exactly when microvessels degrade and the rate at which they degrade, it really did not match up well at all with vascular nitric oxide bioavailability. Vessels started to degrade much earlier in the development of the metabolic syndrome than the fall in NO levels do. Given this disconnect between the loss of vascular nitric oxide bioavailability occurring later than the fall in microvessel density, we had to start looking for different mechanisms that would be contributing to this fall in vascularity within the skeletal muscle. So we had a number of different options facing us and that were associated with chronic inflammation, chronic elevations in oxidant stress, altered arachidonic acid metabolism, but we had so many different pathways to follow that it was really almost impossible for us to identify a single one that merited the best justification. So with that in mind, we entered into a discovery period where we just started broadly phenotyping what is actually happening in these animals at different time periods throughout the development of the metabolic syndrome and the loss of microvessel density, and came up with a large series of sort of candidate biomarkers that would be potentially worthy of future study. At that point, one of my colleagues on this study suggested the use of a multivariate discriminant model, which would give a rank ordering effect, at least statistically, of which parameters and the changes in which parameters contribute the most strongly toward our measured outcome, which in this case is microvessel density. And at that point, we came up with three candidate markers, thromboxane A2 levels, TNF-alpha levels, and reactive oxygen species, all coming out in the top three of the discriminant analysis. So that sort of focused our research, and we started to go through and looking at thromboxane levels with a chronic inhibitor of our chronic blocker of the thromboxane receptor and inhibition of TNF-alpha production, and we started to come up with the sort of this observation that it looks as though the initial phase of microvessel rarefaction appears to be strongly associated with elevations in thromboxane production, thromboxane action, which at this point appear to be downstream from the elevated inflammation and oxidant stress that goes with the development of the metabolic syndrome.
So Victor, I'd like to know if you would mind commenting on the study and what your impressions were of it.
Thank you, Gideon. Well, what I can say is that this is a very well-designed study, and using clinically relevant animal models, this study pretty much brings a great deal of novelty and convincingly demonstrates crucial role for inflammation in pathogenesis of rarefaction in the setting of metabolic syndrome, which, in my opinion, certainly opens up new avenues for future investigations. Personally, for me, particularly interesting finding of this study, I think, is the involvement of thromboxane A2 in promoting inflammatory-induced loss of microvessels density in skeletal muscle of obese rats. In the context of this study, I tend to believe that TXA2 rather functions as a distinct and physiologically relevant pathway, which directly and quite specifically triggers deleterious inflammatory reactions in microvessels of skeletal muscle undergoing metabolic syndrome.
Okay, thanks, Victor. Do you have any questions you'd like to ask Jeff?
Basically, three quick questions. First, why you guys choosing Zucker rat abyss models over high-fat diet model? Second, why pentoxifilin if there is lysophilin, which is pharmacologically active metabolite? And third, which I believe is rather a suggestion, maybe using miniosmotic pumps loaded with drugs and implanted to animals will be a better idea for future experiments, so you wouldn't have to do daily injections, and you would have slow infusion of drugs at permanent rate, which pretty much is a better experimental approach.
The reason we use the obese Zucker rat as opposed to some of the other models of the metabolic syndrome is really the way in which it does develop the disease state. Because its leptin receptor is dysfunctional, it is severely leptin resistant and chronically hyperphagic, it is, in our estimation, a little bit more appropriate model for studying metabolic syndrome in people. It's not that people necessarily are consuming a high-fat diet, which will certainly get you there as well. It's that they're simply consuming too much food, too much of everything, fats, carbohydrates, all of it. So with this chronic overeating on the Zucker rat, we get a steady movement into obesity, the very long period of insulin resistance that is also well associated, also very similar to what we see in the clinic with patients in this situation. They don't rapidly fall into type 2 diabetes. They simply go into long insulin resistance. Now, the hypertension is moderate. So many of these things come out to being very comparable to what we see in the clinical population that affects much of Western society.
Okay, thank you.
The second question was pentoxifilin, why we used that? For lack of a better term, the reason we used pentoxifilin because we had a couple of preliminary studies and pilot studies using pentoxifilin that were very effective in blocking TNF-alpha production, and our pilot experiments showed an excellent blockade of TNF-alpha production, so we chose to stick with it.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. Your data provides a very compelling argument for early changes in thromboxane and the inflammatory pathway in vascular rarefaction. And I'm wondering from a therapeutic standpoint, if this is an early event in vascular rarefaction, what do you speculate are the potential for therapeutics in a individual that already has peripheral vascular disease as an example? Do you think there is any potential for modifying the inflammatory pathway or thromboxane signaling once you have an already established peripheral vascular disease?
That's obviously one of the key questions that I think we have to ask when dealing with patients and subjects suffering from this condition is frequently, although the microcirculation is more modifiable early on, and the ability to sort of pull back from the full manifestation of peripheral vascular disease is superior earlier in the disease process, we tend not to see those people in the clinics. Once things get further along and much more entrenched, so that you do have the rarefaction, you do have the loss of microvessel density, you do have the impairments to perfusion distribution and tissue oxygenation, I think the role for thromboxane actually becomes less significant in terms of microvessel density. And I think it becomes more significant in terms of control of hemodynamics and control of perfusion distribution.
I think it was a very interesting paper. And while most people had concentrated on potential changes in chronic nitric oxide bioavailability and vascular rarefaction in the metabolic syndrome, I think your data has clearly shown they also need to contribute with thromboxane and the inflammatory pathway.
One of the things that did come out of this for me is the concept of temporal resolution. And it is something that we're spending an awful lot of time with right now in trying to understand. It's one thing to start with an animal at 7 weeks of age and then come back at 15 or 17 weeks of age and say, look what we found. And this is what got us off on the nitric oxide kick, because that was our strongest predictor at that point. And when we manipulated nitric oxide in a paper a few years ago, we were able to really change microvessel density. But it is that initial pulse that appears to be entirely nitric oxide independent that I think offers some really compelling opportunities for therapy.
Great, thanks. And I'd like to thank Jeff and Victor for their important insights into this paper, and thanks for participating.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circ podcast. For more podcasts, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.